Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And we are entering our part two called Gentile Nation. Actually, the name of the article that this is drawn from is The Most Significant Gentile Nation in the Bible. And, of course, the one and only David Seeloff is going to work with us on this. He is the speaker and a very good one, and I might add, well studied. He is the director for Associates for Scriptural Knowledge. And if you're interested to write to Associates for Scriptural Knowledge or to David, it's Post Office Box 25000, Portland, Oregon, 97298-0990. And here we go. Hi, David.
Hi, Georgianne. It's good to be back.
Yes. This is a very, very interesting topic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. This article was actually written by Dr. Martin in 1977. And essentially, I'm just going over it and reviewing it to the extent that, you know, I'm kind of reading it, but you and I ask questions back and forth.
Yeah.
And we get off on tangents, which are interesting in themselves. And we have a lot of fun.
Yes, we
but,
do.
But the bulk of the work, we're having fun. The bulk of the work was done by Dr. Ernest Martin, the founder of ASK, back in 1977, before he founded ASK even. And so I've transcribed and edited the article that was, that's now an article. Originally it was a video, an audio tape, which is no longer available because it's better in written form. But the most significant Gentile nation in the Bible are the tribe of Edom, the Edomites, the descendants of Esau. And they're basically the peoples that of Phoenicia. They became some of them created a colony over in the western Mediterranean called Carthage. And they had the Punic Wars with Rome. And they eventually lost and were totally wiped out. But the Phoenicians were great mercantilists and believed in commerce rather than war. And we covered this material last time on how Esau and Jacob were actually twins.
Yes.
And the Edomites look a lot like Jews. Of course they do, because they're twins. And the first founder of the Edomites was Esau, and Edom means red because Esau was red, and with the different vowels, and of course Hebrew doesn't have any vowels, so it depends on the context. Edom in some cases also means Adam, and we discussed that a little bit in some cases. Sometimes they're mixed up, actually.
Well, you know, when you say, David, that Edom also means red, I've heard numerous people state that the Jews originally, you know, the way back when before the bloodline became too intermixed with other people, that they were redheads, and that a lot of the red-haired Irish are actually of Judah.
Yeah, that gets to what I consider a discredited theory of British Israelism.
Okay.
That the French come from the tribe of Reuben, and the Danes are the tribe of Dan, and the Norwegians are, let's see, I believe, Naphtali. And there's just nothing to that. If you read the book of James, the 12 tribes kept the Sabbath and the holy days, and they understood what you and I would call Jewish things. Well, the Irish don't keep the didn't keep the Sabbath when they were at the time of Christ, when James wrote. James wrote to the 12 tribes scattered abroad. And they understood everything. Those tribes were still located, according to Josephus, around the Babylonian area, around the area of Babylon, ancient Babylon, which was still a thriving city in the time of the Roman Empire. And, you know, it was the other center of Judaism, and stayed a center of Judaism after Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 A.D. Mm-hmm. But the ruddy, actually David is said to be a ruddy youth.
A ruddy complexion?
Yeah, somehow red, whether he had red hair, we don't know. He was in 1 Samuel 16, chapter 16, verse 2, he was ruddy and with a beautiful countenance and goodly to look at. Whether this means that he was red-haired or red-complected, other than, you know, more than the norm, I don't know. But you have to remember that most of the people in the Mediterranean area today or whenever have very weathered skin.
Yes.
Which in the Song of Solomon is what made the woman in the Song of Solomon. She was also described as ruddy, but also white.
Mm-hmm.
So whether the ruddiness had to do with her hair, although it says her head was as fine gold. This is in Song of Solomon, chapter 5, verse 10. It's talking about Solomon, not about the woman. But, so Solomon was white and ruddy, and yet had golden hair. It says his head is as fine gold in verse 11, and his locks are bushy and black as raven.
Yeah.
So, perhaps David might have had red hair. It seems that Edom had red hair, but that only applied to him and not the whole tribe of Edom. Now, Edom is separate from Jacob, and then Jacob had broken up into the 12 tribes of Israel. Likewise, Edom had children, and they're scattered about in the different areas also. So, Edom is a very interesting people because they always have a relationship with Israel during the time of David. King Hiram of Tyre, mm-hmm. King of Tyre, was of Edom and a Phoenician. And he had a good relationship with King David as equals. Now, Israel could not make, was never supposed to be subordinate to other nations, but they could make equal treaties with other nations fairly on a free basis. But they were not to submit to any other nation unless God approved.
Right.
For fear that their gods would, the pagan gods would, infiltrate Israel, which of course they did in the northern kingdom, and also to the southern kingdom, but on a slower pace. And the Edomites were always there, but the Edomites are different than Syria, than the Syrians, the people of Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And also they were also located somewhat to the southeast of Jerusalem on the other side of the Dead Sea and the Jordan River. So they're located all over. So it's because of intermarriage, it's a little difficult to sort them out. But God will sort them out, as he has done in Psalm 83, and he gives us a future snapshot as to who will be where, at what location, which nations around Jerusalem in the future before the time of the end. And of course, we also discussed last time that the entire book of Obadiah,
yeah,
the short 21 verses, completely talks about the people of Edom. And the book of Obadiah is repeated in the book of Jeremiah, and that in both places, in Jeremiah and Obadiah, it uses what's called a prophetic past tense, in that it speaks of something as being in the past, and yet it's still a future prophecy because God speaking from his point of view as if it has already happened. Then we talked about the pride of Edom and how they thought they were all so great, and this is in Obadiah verses 3 to 5, and the wisdom of Edom is discussed in Obadiah 6 and in Jeremiah 49 verse 7. And then the wisdom is further talked about in Obadiah verse 8, 7, 8, and 9. So some people, because of a verse in Obadiah verse 9, there are no books. There's only one book of Obadiah, so it's one chapter of Obadiah, so it's verse 9. In verse 9 of Obadiah, it says, quote, "And your mighty men, O Teman, shall be dismayed, to the end that every one of the mount of Esau may be cut off by slaughter." And this is for the future. Now, some have thought that this phrase, O Teman, meant the Ottomans, and that they were the people of Edom. But that doesn't really mean anything in Hebrew. O Teman has nothing to do with the Hebrew at all. So we can actually discard that. Let me see here. Actually, Dr. Martin wrote on in a book of his, a 1993 book, called The People That History Forgot, in chapter 28, page 163, he says, quote, "For all practical purposes, the nationalities of the Moabites, Ammonites, and Edomites ceased to be reckoned as distinct peoples any longer in the Middle East, so far as you and I would know. Mm-hmm. Their areas were, as we have explained earlier in his book, reverted to a type of a desert environment and peoples from the peripheral lands, the desert, the Arabs, and came into these unpopulated regions. This is when the Idumeans and other peoples, other nations around Palestine, sort of disappear from history and become a part of that group of races who blended in with the people that history forgot." Now, literally, the people of Edom are the people that history forgot, and the whole book is about that subject and
that
how...
That is a fascinating book.
Yeah, and how syncretism infiltrated Christianity and the Edomites. When Jews were in favor with the Romans, the Edomites would associate themselves with the Jewish and Israelite people, and say they were Israelite.
Yeah.
When the Jews were out of favor, like during the time of Constantine, they'd say, oh no, we're different than the Jews. So they would play both sides fast and loose. I believe that actually... Muhammad is an Idumean. Now, the Idumeans were the tribe of King Herod.
Yeah.
And Herod went to great lengths to associate himself with the Jews when he was their king.
Mm-hmm.
And actually had a... Josephus talks, the Jewish historian Josephus, says that King Herod actually had a false genealogy created to prove his Jewish roots, even though he wasn't.
Well, there's people today that do that also.
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah.
All the time.
And he was handy at having people's heads cut off.
Yes, actually. That's true. Continuing on with what Dr. Martin quotes, "That does not end the matter, however, especially with the Idumeans or Edomites. This is because the Jewish authorities have kept up with the migrations of their brethren, the Edomites, Edomites or Esau, their twin brother to Jacob, and their descendants. And the Jews reckon that many of the Edomites migrated west, even unto North Africa and Rome." So Dr. Martin shows, end quote, Dr. Martin shows in this book that actually the present population of the people of Italy, particularly in the Roman area, are essentially Edomites. Although there's been a lot of inbreeding and everything else. Now, but that is a very interesting situation. In verse 10 of the book of Obadiah, and we're jumping around here, but it's necessary. It'd be best to read this article and follow along if you can when you listen to this program. But in verse 10 of Obadiah, it shows the destruction that is coming against Edom, the Edomites, the Esau,
yes,
the twin brother to Jacob. Quote in verse 10, "For your violence against your brother Jacob, because of your violence, shame shall cover you, and you shall be cut off forever," it says in the King James. But the word is olam, which really means to the age. In other words, there will be a period of time, usually a long period of time, in which the people of Edom will be cut off. Now, the Edomites were a close brother to Jacob, and they were twins. And it's true that Esau at first had hair all over him like a goat, Genesis 25:25, but Esau's descendants did not have hair like that. That was a peculiarity just with him. And that is the reason he got the name Esau, which means hairy. Mm-hmm. Now, at the same time, long hair has always been a sign of prophetic office that Esau had and some of his descendants. So they would literally, almost all of the prophets of ancient Israel wore a hairy garment that is sometimes called a rough garment. Talks Zechariah, or Zechariah chapter 13, verse 4, talks about a rough garment to deceive, a woolen garment that they put around them.
Yeah.
Remember that John the Baptist, as a sign of his a prophet, being a prophet, even though he didn't make prophecies, he preached. To be a prophet means you also preach and tell the truth and tell the word of God, not just that you're foretelling the future. And John the Baptist actually, I don't think, made any prophecies except regarding Christ, which were to occur in months after he preached them. And then he was taken away off the scene, John the Baptist was.
Mm-hmm.
So John the Baptist wore a hairy mantle, a hairy garment, much like Esau did. And there's actually a medical term for hairiness, and I don't know what it is, but I know that there is such a term. So Esau was born with a hairy garment on him like a goat skin. And this is why Jacob was able to put on the goat skin and impersonate his brother when Jacob was really old and couldn't see and couldn't hear very well, and Jacob stole the blessing from Esau that was supposed to go to the firstborn. This is all in Genesis 25.
Right.
I don't know if it's chapter 25, but it's in that story about Jacob and Esau. So the ancients looked upon Esau as being born with a prophetic spirit, but it was only peculiar to him, and his children did not have hair all over them, and they would have looked like any ordinary Israelite would have, because the people were twins. Esau married two Canaanite wives and also an Ishmaelite wife.
And that was very much against his father's wishes.
I don't remember that.
Yeah, that's in there where his father asked him not to do that, not to take a mm-hmm. wife from among those people.
Yeah, I know Jacob did not.
Right.
He married in Laban's family.
Mm-hmm.
He got more than he bargained for. He got two wives.
Yeah.
But Esau had three,
yeah.
But Edom was still a brother to Jacob, and they appeared very similar in appearance. Now, Obadiah, verse 10 and 11 says, quote, "For your violence against your brother Jacob, shame shall cover you, and you shall be cut off for the age. In the day that you stood on the other side," end quote. Now, this refers to the other side, or the east side of the Jordan River. And this is in the future when the Israelites will try to escape from Jerusalem and the area surrounding it. And when they are being invaded by people, the Israelites will be taken over and conquered. And here is their brother people of the of Edom right next door to them. A large group of Edomites are congregated to the east of the Jordan River. Mm-hmm. The Israelites try to escape from the horrors that are being put upon them from the nations. And instead of giving Israel help in a time of need, they stand to the side and they actually prevent Israel from escaping.
Oh, no.
And God is very angry because of this betrayal of a brother. In other words, all this hatred that is welled up and is welling up right now between the Edomites and the Edomites right now would essentially be some peoples in Lebanon and in Jordan.
Right.
And some
Lebanon
of those...
Lebanon right now is massing on the border again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the... probably some of the Palestinians will also be considered and will separate themselves as Edomites. Mm-hmm. God will sort these peoples out, but they will, according to Psalm 83, will be somewhat designated in certain areas around Israel. Now, God is angry because of this betrayal of Israel, Jacob, by Esau. And in Obadiah verse 11, it says, quote, "In that day that you stood on the other side, in that day that the strangers carried away captive his," or Jacob's, "forces, and foreigners entered into his gates," in other words, into the city, "and cast lots upon Jerusalem, even you were as one of them." In other words, mm-hmm. Edom participated in the assault that the ten nations will make on Jerusalem. In other words, God is saying that you, Edom, were willing to cast lots to divvy up and divide portions of Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. Now, this has never happened in the history of the world.
But it is now, isn't it?
Well, Israel hasn't been taken captive, certainly not to the extent that...
The talk of dividing Jerusalem is what I'm referring to.
Yeah, this is a Vatican plan that I don't think will succeed. I think we're talking about a more unified Jerusalem, and it'll be specific nations that will invade, and it'll be the, the Vatican, frankly, I think the Vatican and the Catholic Church will implode within itself.
Yeah.
And will dissolve. Now, we could have long discussions about that, I'm sure, but I just don't see it being a viable power at the end time. It'll be a shadow of its former self.
Mm-hmm.
When truth comes out, much of the, in my understanding, much of that theology will be found wanting, and...
they've employed... the trickery that they've employed in, and just all kinds of things, David. It's going to come out, all of it.
Yeah, it will. The scandals that have been occurring,
mm-hmm.
It's tip of the iceberg.
Yes. Oh,
and
wow, you're right.
It's just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I've written a little bit on that, but nothing really formal article. Up here in Oregon, where we're located, the Catholic Church is bankrupt. In the local corporations that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also happening out east and in other places. And they're selling off land and that people have granted to them over the years.
Right.
And it's really... quite amazing. If the money stops, the American Church, the Americans support the Catholic Church with funds like is not done anywhere else in the world.
Mm-hmm. True.
South America is devoutly Catholic, mostly, It's probably the strongest Catholic area in the world, but they don't really support the church other than local congregations.
Mm-hmm.
They don't support the international church. This is why the American Catholic groups are segment is so important to the Catholic Church. This is the big money.
Mm-hmm.
If the big money stops, they certainly don't get much from Europe.
Right.
They primarily support their local congregations. The international structure is supported by the United States, and if that collapses, you know, you're going to see a lot of stuff being sold.
Oh, sure.
Big fire sale.
Yeah.
And, you know, eventually with the restitution of all things, even the theology will be seen to be, will be questioned and found wanting. So these things that have been prophesied in Obadiah verse 11 have not happened before. They did not happen in the 6th century in 586 B.C. when the Babylonians under King Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem. Edomites did not assist in that. The temple was destroyed absolutely, and every building in Jerusalem was gutted.
Yeah.
And, you know, it wasn't until 70 years later that the Jews came back to rebuild. So these prophecies, and Obadiah had spoken by that time, but these prophecies did not occur at the time of Nebuchadnezzar or Jeremiah. They still have not occurred. They did not occur in 70 AD. To the extent that the Romans were Edomites, the Romans destroyed Jerusalem themselves. They didn't just help somebody else in a minor way. They let it. So that what you've got here is, though it says that lots will be cast upon about Jerusalem, for Jerusalem, those lots will be cast for certain peoples, and the Edomites are going to be right there to receive some portion of Jerusalem.
What does it mean that it'll be cast for certain peoples?
They're going to divide it up.
Okay.
They're going to divide it up into sections, just like Germany was after World War II in Berlin. Berlin was split up into three sections.
Oh, dear.
Four sections.
Yeah.
Russia, France, Britain and the United States each took a section, and even led to the Berlin crisis. Well, this will happen in Jerusalem also at some time in the future. Jerusalem will be taken over by several nations, and the Edomites, as Israel brothers to Israelite, will be there, should be there to help Israel, but they get in line. They stand in the way and don't let the people escape, and then they Jerusalem is exposed and up for grabs. And many of the Jews in Jerusalem, many of the Israelites, I'm using those terms synonymous at that time because they will be unified at that time, will be taken as slaves to Babylon, some to Egypt, and some to the territory of Assyria. And there will be another exodus that will bring all those people back after the second coming. So Edom will participate with their neighbors, demanding that they get a share of the plunder, and God will punish Edom horribly for that.
Right.
So the nations draw lots for Jerusalem. Now let's take a look at the evil that Edom will do to their twin brother Jacob. Now, there's eight things that Edom does, and this is all in Obadiah verses 12 to 15. But, God says, quote, but, first of all, you should not have looked on the day of your brother in the day that he became a stranger. In other words, Edom looked on Jacob as if, well, we don't really know those people.
Yeah.
Second, neither should you have rejoiced over the children of Judah in the day of their destruction. Three, neither should you have spoken proudly in the day of distress. In other words, proud of their participation in Judah's destruction. Four, you should not have entered into the gate of your people in the day of their calamity. In other words, to take over their territory.
Right.
And five, you, meaning Edom, you should not have looked on their affliction in the day of their calamity. In other words, looked on and not done anything to help.
Right.
Six, nor should you have laid hands on their sustenance, on their substance, in the day of their calamity. In other words, they took pillage and will take pillage.
Well, yeah.
They'll take all the flat-screen TVs and, you know, the women and everything else. And this is all described in unfortunate detail in Zechariah.
Yeah.
The book of Zechariah of just this situation. Seven, neither should you have stood in the crossway to cut off those of his that did escape. In other words, they will not only help and participate, but they will prevent those few who try to escape from getting away. And eight, neither should you have delivered up those of his that did remain in the day of distress. In other words, those that remained in the city and were hidden,
mm-hmm.
were found out by some of the Edomites, and were turned in.
Oh, gee. Oh.
So it just gets worse and worse and worse, you know.
And this is to come now.
This is to come. And like one guy, one person said, you can always bet on human depravity.
Whoever said that is has a good understanding of human nature.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then the verse closes off in Obadiah, verse 15, for the day of the Lord is near upon all the heathen.
Amen.
Yeah. And this is, so Obadiah is specifically about the tribe of Edom, the Edomites,
mm-hmm.
and goes through all these things in great detail of what they will do to their brother Judah and Jacob. So this kind of gives you a time period that we're talking about here, just before the day of the Lord at Jerusalem. And this is relevant, of course, to the second coming of Christ, and it's associated with that time. Obadiah, once again, verse 15 and 16. Quote, for the day of the Lord is near upon all the heathen, as you have done, you, Edom, have done, it shall be done unto you. Your reward shall return upon your own head. For as you have drunk upon my holy mountain, so shall all the heathen, all of the nations, drink continually. Yea, they shall drink, and they shall swallow down, and they shall be as though they had not been, meaning Edom. So that the nations, after they finish off with Israel, they're going to turn on Edom. And Edom will be punished just as bad. The Edomites will go into the Jerusalem, into the temple. They take it over. They will cast lots with the heathen over the city and the whole territory when they should have been helping their brother Jacob. And then God will have the nations turn on Edom. And that will be a bitter pill for Esau to swallow. Now, Obadiah verse 17. You know, I'm sorry, but sometimes we do like to see the bad guy get it.
Yeah, and that's part of human nature, too.
To get justice, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But they did that to God's chosen people. So, you know, you don't mess with things like this. Now, verse 17 of Obadiah, quote, but upon Mount Zion shall be deliverance, and there shall be holiness, and the house of Jacob shall possess their possessions, in other words, sometime again in the future,
mm-hmm.
and the house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau for stubble mm-hmm. in that flame, and they shall kindle in them and devour them, and there shall not be any remaining. Once again, as we covered perhaps last time, I think it was last time that we mentioned that there will not be one male left alive of the Edomites. For there shall not be any remaining of the house of Esau. In other words, no men.
Yeah.
Every single man that participates will be killed. And will still be women and children left, and they'll be able to rebuild in the millennium. But Esau, the tribe of Edom, will be greatly diminished. There's a parallel passage to this book of Obadiah in Jeremiah chapter 49, verse 11. And it says that the women and children would be left. And after all, there would be no more Edomite nation if there was no one left. But the male adults, all of them will be killed off, and there shall not be one male remaining. Obadiah, verse 18 and 19, quote, "For the Lord has spoken it, and they of the south," meaning Judah, "shall possess the mount of Esau, and they of the plain," in other words, near the Mediterranean, the southern area of Esau, "and they of the plain," the Philistines, "and they," meaning northern Israel of the tribe of Joseph, "shall possess the fields of Ephraim and the fields of Samaria, and Benjamin shall possess Gilead." In other words, after the day of the Lord, Israel will once again reoccupy that area, the areas that I just described in Obadiah verse 18 and 19. And the millennium will begin, and it will flourish once again. Now, it's not going to be good times right away, because actually the good times won't occur for some 70 years after Christ returns, simply because the earth will be needed to recover all over the world. The earth will be in very, very bad shape from what God does to it. There's going to be a lot of destruction on the earth, and probably a lot of stuff in the atmosphere from the asteroids, that meteorites that crash to the earth, and they're going to be very large ones. In other words, it's describing in Obadiah that there will be a second exodus in the future, and Israel will finally be able to be in the land in safety, and they will possess it from then on. But before they do that, this attack will have to happen, and Esau, their brother, coming with the heathen to destroy Israel from being a nation. Once again, in verse 20 of Obadiah, going back to still future to us, but spoken of as being in the past tense. Quote, "And the captivity of this host of the children of Israel," those that were taken into captivity, "shall possess that of the Canaanite, even unto Zarephath," which is a city north of Tyre, "and the captivity of Jerusalem," which is in Sepharad, which is also north of Jerusalem, "shall possess the cities of the south." It even states where the peoples are and where they came from. That's how specific this prophecy is. "And saviors," similar to the judges of old at the time of Joshua, "and saviors shall come up on Mount Zion to judge the Mount of Esau, and the kingdom," in other words of Esau, "shall be the Lord's." God will own Edom, Esau, and because there won't be any males alive, actually God will take charge of their rebuilding, the rebuilding of Esau.
When it uses the word saviors, plural, what might we think, who are they?
They'll probably be natural leaders who will come up and guide the people to do what they need to do.
Okay.
Just remarkable people who have themselves been survivors. And when God suddenly turns everything around, they will organize everyone. And that's what it means.
Okay.
Nothing supernatural or spiritual in that regard.
Okay.
But this verse 21 concludes the book of Obadiah. And this is when Esau will come with the nations, and instead of helping Israel, will help the nations attack Israel. And it's called a covenant or a confederacy, and Esau will be a part of all of this. And they will cast lots over Jerusalem, because at that time, Jerusalem will be essentially the capital city of the world in many areas, particularly the religious sphere. whether this has to do with outward religious aspect, or it might even mean mystery Babylon. But what Esau will want to take over, will want to participate in that world possession, you might say. And this is what it says when you put all the scriptures together. But Esau will be put down. In other words, the world will invade and attack Israel and Jerusalem with the purpose of making Jerusalem the capital of the world. And that won't last very long. Now, in Isaiah chapter 34, there are also some very interesting prophetic comments about Esau. And, you know, in the King James Version, it's a little problematic. And it, actually, if in the Hebrew, it's correct. And it's actually better to have a some of the other translations about the prophecy of, especially about some of these prophecies, because they just didn't understand like we do some of the vocabulary of non-biblical material wasn't quite as large. It's not very large at all now, but still we've learned a few things since then with Ugaritic and other things, none of which I can read, but this is what I've read from secondary sources. The scriptures, there's also some scriptures in the book of Revelation dealing with the end time that are somewhat parallel to Obadiah and to the passages in Isaiah that we're going to be covering. So this is Isaiah chapter 34, and Babylon and Esau seem to have a relationship, merged together in some way, but not really. Some of the things described in chapter 34 are actually talking about Esau and Edom. They're not talking about Babylon, and this is because many commentators have misunderstood, according to Dr. Martin, that a similar destruction will occur both to Esau and to Babylon. And it's so similar that some people have said, you know, we're talking about Babylon here. But the punishment on Babylon occurs in Isaiah chapter 13 and 14. And also Jeremiah chapters 50 and 51 all talk about the destruction of Babylon. Isaiah chapters 15 and 16 talks about Moab and Ammon. Then he goes on to other nations, talking about punishments to come on. And all of these are the nations discussed in Obadiah, in general, are specified in Isaiah. Then he gets to Egypt. And the very last nation that Isaiah deals with in chapter 34 of Isaiah is the nation of Edom. And the reason he is the last one is because really, he is the most important Gentile nation as far as the Israelites are concerned. And as we read this small, short chapter of Isaiah chapter 34, you will see the relevance of it and how at the end of the age, Edom and or Esau will have a major role to play in bringing the nations of the world against Judah and against Jerusalem. God will be angry concerning it.
Yes.
And remember, God said, according to Paul in Romans 9:13, that Esau have I hated,
Yes. And
Jacob have I loved. Now, that's just in relative terms, but it's also because of some specific things that Esau will do. And I'm sure they'll have justifications, and they might have justifications even in our minds, but it's God's judgment that counts here.
Right.
The Edomites will all be redeemed in some time in the future, even though they're killed. But they have a role to play in this world before that redemption. And in Isaiah chapter 34, verse 1, it says, quote, Come near, you nations, to hear, and hearken, you people. Let the earth hear, and all that is therein, the world and all things that come forth of it. In other words, a general announcement is saying, all right, everybody, pay attention to what God is going to be doing here. And there is an appeal to the entire world. Verse 2 of Isaiah 34, quote, "For the indignation of the Lord is upon all nations, and his fury upon all their armies. He has utterly destroyed them, and he has delivered them to the slaughter." Now, again, this is the prophetic past tense being used when he is talking about a time in the future. Now, Isaiah 34, verses 3 and 4, quote, "Their slain also shall be cast out, and their stink shall come up out of their carcasses, and the mountains shall be melted with their blood."
Mm.
Now, have you read that somewhere in the New Testament? Well, yes. It goes on in Isaiah 34. Quote, "And all their host shall fall down." We read this in Daniel and Book of Revelation about stars falling from the heavens at a particular time in the future. In Luke chapter 21 of the Olivet Prophecy, we hear about heavenly signs and stars falling and all of that.
Right.
It's a reference to this time period when all the nations of the world will be dealt with. And let's go on in chapter 34, verses 4 and 5 of Isaiah. Quote, "And all their hosts shall fall down as the leaf falls from the vine, and as a falling fig from the fig tree. For my sword shall be bathed in heaven. Behold, it shall come down upon Idumea." In other words, Esau. In the Hebrew, it just says Esau.
Boy, that's pretty explicit. Wow.
God's sword is going to be bathed in heaven. What it's going to be doing up there is not exactly clear. But it shall come down upon Idumea, upon Edom. You know, it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God.
Oh, yeah.
And they're going to know it. Idumea is actually Edom. In every other place that this Hebrew word occurs, it's translated Edom. In verse 4 and 5, verses 4 and 5 again, "For my sword shall be bathed in heaven. Behold, it shall come down upon Edom and upon the people of my curse to judgment," end quote. He says they are, for people of Edom are, quote, "the people of my curse," end quote. From the very beginning, Esau was fighting against Jacob in the womb.
Yes.
And one was to be evil in a relative sense, and one was to be good. And we find this carrying on right to the second coming of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And this fight is described in Isaiah chapter 34, continuing on in verse 5 to 7. Quote, "The people of my curse to judgment. The sword of the Lord is filled with blood, and it is made fat with fatness, and with the blood of lambs and goats, and with the fat of kidneys and rams. For the Lord has a sacrifice in Bozrah," which is a city in Edom,
mm-hmm,
"and a great slaughter in the land of Edom," Idumea, Edom, "and the unicorns shall come down with them, and the bullocks with the bulls, and their land shall be soaked with blood, and the dust made fat with fatness." All of these animals that are being described are clean animals, which are going to be, you know, animals for sacrifice.
Well, what do they mean by unicorn?
I'm not sure what the King James people had. Let me look that up quick.
Okay.
Isaiah 34, verse 6. See what the other translations have. It's actually verse 7 here. So, oh, come on.
See,
okay.
I think unicorn has some application to Cain.
I had never heard that. They say wild oxen in some of the more modern translations. Almost all of them do. But why the King James would have gotten that wrong, I don't know. There was a, I remember, was it the 70s? I think it was the 1980s. there was a big to-do in the press about a fella who had bred a unicorn from goats. In other words, as he would choose the goats for mating that would have the horns that would tend toward each other, and within three generations he had a unicorn as the horns in this actually grew together.
Well, you know, corn, Cain, and king have the same root.
I don't know. Corn is an American term meaning maize. A corn in Europe and in the Middle East just means wheat. And it's difficult to do English associations like that.
I know.
Well, anyway, back to Isaiah. But it's talking about whatever it is, all the other animals that it's being discussed are indeed clean animals for sacrifice. So this is a symbol that the people of Edom are being set up as sacrifices by God himself, not by people doing human sacrifice. God can kill people and punish them any moment he wants.
Right.
And he probably does it more often than we know.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to the book of Revelation, chapter 19, you find the same description given there in a slightly different language, but also about discussing a great slaughter and a great sacrifice occurring at the end of the age when Christ comes with his sword in his hands.
Isn't this spoken of in the book of Revelation as this great feast that the birds come and...
I don't think... Is that in Revelation?
Yeah, about the birds, the carrion, eating the flesh of all the dead.
No, that's somewhere else. It escapes me right now.
Okay.
Of where that exactly is. I know what you're referring to, but I can't think of where that is right now. In chapter 34, verse 8 of Isaiah, it says, quote, "For it is the day of the Lord's vengeance and the year of recompenses for the controversy of Zion," end quote. So that wherever you see the day of the Lord, that's essentially where you'll find a discussion of this general time period. Now, this day and year, this time has not happened yet in history. It's still future to us, and the book of Revelation shows that it's still future. Let's go to Revelation chapter 19 and see what that has here. The rider on the white horse, the beast in his... verse 11. Yeah, it talks about... he goes, verse 15 of chapter 19 of Revelation.
Right.
"The armies which were in heaven followed him upon white horses, clothed in fine linen and clean." Now, these are angelic armies. They're not us in resurrection. That comes at a different time. "And out of his mouth goes a sharp sword, and with it he will smite the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron, and tread the winepress of the fierceness and the wrath of God." And verse 18 about the flesh of kings, and making army against war against the beast.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's talking about that to a certain extent there. So that this hasn't happened yet. References in the Bible from the very beginning of Esau struggling in the womb with Jacob all the way through Scripture, even to Revelation, we find Edom fulfilling a role of being a people of a curse, just like Isaiah chapter 34, verse 5 says.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fairly interesting that the the king over Judah in our time, in the time that our Lord was born, almost had him killed. Remember when the king said to kill all the male infants around Bethlehem?
Right.
That was Herod, who was an Edomite, as I said.
Yeah.
And God will do the same thing. This time God will kill all the males of the Edomites.
Well, when you look through Scripture, they're pretty bloodthirsty people.
Well, everybody was. Yeah, everybody was. I mean, the Israelites, the Jews, the Romans, everyone was horrible, and each was more horrible than the previous one for whatever reason. Isaiah chapter 34, verse 8 to 10, it says, quote, "For this is the day of the Lord's vengeance and the year of recompense for the controversy of Zion. And the streams thereof shall be turned into pitch, and the dust thereof into brimstone, and the land thereof shall become burning pitch, and it shall not be quenched night nor day."
What does that mean, David?
It means the lake of the Dead Sea will catch fire.
Okay.
And it has done so in the past. Actually, there's a lot of oil down there. They just have been very unlucky and haven't been able to discover it yet. That's a very interesting subject. We should do a program on that.
Yes.
Dr. Martin wrote an article in 1981 titled "Oil Soon to be Discovered in Israel."
Wow. Yeah.
Now, it hasn't happened yet still, by God's choice.
They're talking about it, and it is in mainstream news.
Yeah.
That they're looking for it. But I remember one of the sessions that you and I did. You know, I could just picture, this Dead Sea is on fire. And, that had to be like big entertainment. People had to have walked from long ways to see.
Sure.
It was pretty amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. And there was big bubbles of oil and pitch,
yeah,
and that would glob up in the Dead Sea. Then rise to the surface. Now, of course, the Dead Sea is diminished from what it was in Christ's day considerably. I've been there and swum in it, but it floated in it anyway. It's an interesting phenomena, but it's very greasy.
Mm.
And in the past, lightning would strike it and it would catch fire. And this is the lake of fire.
Wow.
Which will, at a future time during the millennium, will literally be where Satan and the spirit entity who will possess the false prophet,
mm-hmm,
will be cast into. The physical bodies of those two humans will be destroyed, but the spirit entities that possess them will be in the lake of fire, and a whole bunch of others too.
I've heard people say, for example, that the lake of fire is the sun.
Well, we'll show you in that article.
Yeah.
We have another article. Perhaps we can do them both side by back to back.
Okay.
About the lake of fire, and then a separate article on oil to be discovered regarding the Dead Sea.
But it's like you and I have talked before. When these scriptures were written, for us today, it's not easy for us to put ourselves in that time and the understanding that people had at that time.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly.
Now, even in the time of Christ, the prophecies regarding Christ occurred, but they didn't get it until Christ, after the resurrection, Christ came and explained the prophecies to them.
Wow. Yeah.
And even then, it's difficult for us today because they didn't sit down and say, okay, this verse applies here, that verse applies here.
Right.
In John, I believe it's John 19, it talks about at the crucifixion when Jesus was stabbed with the spear.
Mm-hmm.
It says specifically, this fulfills the verse that they will recognize him whom they have pierced.
Ooh.
But they did not recognize him whom they have pierced. A lot of Jews did initially, and the Israelites did initially come over, even 3,000 in the first couple of days, and then almost all of the priests in the temple became believers.
Yeah.
It says that specifically, a multitude of priests, most of whom were Sadducees, by the way. Most of the priests were Sadducees who didn't believe in supernatural at all.
Yeah.
Most amazing. But then, you know, there was diminishing returns, diminishing conversions, and diminishing miracles, too. But at the end time, these prophecies, we'll be able to literally be able to have them like a checklist. Okay, this fulfills that. This fulfills that. Otherwise, what good are they?
You're right.
They're written for us and for future generations, but at this time of the end, things will be understandable for those who are wise. It says that specifically in the book of Daniel.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to be wise. In other words, you have to take the scripture at face value and not read into it goofy and spiritualized things away, like my personal tradition that I grew up in, Lutheranism, where, oh, well, everything's spiritual. We don't really care about the history.
Uh-huh.
You know, it didn't really, we don't really believe it anyway, says the pastor, and, you know, just, they're, yeah, some of it happened, but they're real nice stories. No, they're prophecies.
Right.
So much of it is prophecy that will be coming to pass. Now, what we had just, mentioned in Isaiah 34:8-10, you can also look this up in Revelation 19:3. Same thing. Continuing on in verse 10. Quote, the smoke thereof, the smoke which will occur against Edom, shall go up forever for the age. From generation to generation it shall lie waste. None shall pass through it forever and ever. In other words, for the age of the ages. In other words, for the millennium and the age after that, it's going to be so bad there, nothing's going to go through that territory. Now, this is very reminiscent of what's prophesied for Babylon. But this is not Babylon being talked about here. This is Edom, the area southeast of the Dead Sea. Verse 11, Isaiah 34. But the cormorant and the bittern shall possess it, and the owl also, and the raven shall dwell in it. In other words, there's going to be fewer animals living there than there are in the Dead Sea area right now.
Huh.
Now, the cormorant and the bittern and the owl and the raven are all unclean animals.
Yeah.
The clean animals were the sacrificial animals of verses 6 and 7 of Isaiah 34, representing the nations of the world. They were slaughtered there. And after that takes place, then what happens? Well, the unclean animals come in. Verse 11 to 13 of Isaiah 34, quote, and he shall stretch out upon it the line of confusion and the stones of emptiness. I don't really know what those mean specifically. Perhaps we'll know as we come closer. They shall call the nobles, in other words, the nobles of Edom, thereof to the kingdom, but none shall be there, and all her princes shall be nothing. And the thorns that shall come up in her palaces, nettles and brambles in the fortresses thereof. And it shall be a habitation of dragons and a court of for owls. Now, don't ask me about dragons. I don't know. I haven't worked through all of that information, whether that just means reptiles, very possibly. Or it might mean big reptiles. I don't know.
Couldn't it also mean demonic presence?
Not in the millennium, no.
Okay.
They're all going to be busy.
Yeah.
They're all going to be tied up.
Yeah, okay.
Tied up at the moment. But it does talk about palaces and fortresses. Okay. That means before this happens, there's going to be a lot of prosperity southeast of the Dead Sea.
Mm-hmm.
That means for there to be a lot of prosperity, they either have to discover oil, although Jordan would participate in oil being discovered in the Dead Sea,
mm-hmm.
or there's going to be a severe climate change for the good for the people of the Middle East. Might not be so good for other people, but for the people in the Middle East, there might be a climate change. Now, I'm going to digress for a moment. If we're talking about all sorts of climate change, and we, you know, have an article on the website about weather, and you and I want to cover that in greater detail.
Right.
About weather, how weather used to be in Old Testament and New Testament times.
Okay. Yeah.
Very interesting information. Now, it used to be fertile all through that area, even in, as far as Saudi Arabia and even as up the Sahara. If the climate would change to make that possible, what you need is a lot more moisture in the air. And what do we have happening? We have the ice caps melting. That does not necessarily mean that the coastlines will, that the ocean will rise. It may mean that there will just be more rain in areas where there isn't any. In the Sahara.
Right.
In Saudi Arabia. In Israel. In the Gobi Desert. And if there's more rain in Siberia and Canada, if things get warmer, then that means millions and millions of acres are opened up to productive farmland.
Right.
And also in the Middle East. And it will be as if a millennium is occurring of good times and good crops.
Right.
Specifically England, I don't know, if the Gulf Stream would shift south, say to Spain or the or over North Africa. And by the way, there's signs that the Sahara is already shrinking, as you can see from some satellite composite photos. The green is coming up from the south in the Sahara Desert as more moisture is in the air of the atmosphere. Global warming might not be that bad.
Well, David, we would have to have the moisture, a lot of moisture, going up into the upper atmosphere in order to make the hailstones that are going to come down.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's at a specific time. But those hailstones are going to come down on verdant and green fields.
Yeah.
They aren't there. You go to Israel and it's
yeah.
a desert except where there's irrigation. Now,
yeah.
It's even worse than, you know, the Imperial Valley. We can make deserts bloom, but nobody does it better than God.
Absolutely.
Quite frankly.
Yeah.
He can make deserts bloom, and that's, you know, for there to be a fake, for people to proclaim that the millennium has already come during the time of the Antichrist,
mm-hmm.
there has to be a long-term buildup of good times. In the time of Jesus, in the areas where Jesus preached the Beatitudes, he preached those and everyone was sitting on green grass.
Mm.
There's no green grass over there.
Yeah.
I've been there recently and there's no green grass over there. And, you know, they weren't sitting on rock. And it supported a population at that time of about 2 to 3 million people in just Palestine. Same number that they have there today. And they were a lot less productive on their farming. So that means the land must have been terrific to support all those people.
Yeah.
And Josephus says they, you know, at least 1.5 to 2 million people were killed off in the war. Then they took about, you know, hundreds of thousands of slaves, the
yes.
Romans did.
Yes.
And not counting those who fled, you know, the church fled. And I imagine a lot of people fled to Egypt and to Damascus and other areas, those who were not committed or those who weren't, you know, Israelites.
Right.
Right. Just to get out of the way. People do that if they can. So, you know, it talks about in Isaiah chapter 34, verse 13, 11 to 13, talks about palaces and fortresses. And this is of time future to us. It's not talking about Saddam Hussein's palaces. It's talking about a lot of palaces and a lot of fortresses that will become, you know, desolate again. Well, it's desolate now. So something has to change to make good times before the destruction can come on there.
Right.
And that's going to take a lot of time. And I keep trying to, you know, emphasize this to people that we've got a long way to go yet, probably about, you know, 75 to 100 years. They don't like to hear that because, you know, we're all been put up, whether it's through Hal Lindsey or Herbert Armstrong or, you know, a lot of these self-proclaimed prophets, they do their best with Scripture, but they just haven't been given the insight to read this stuff more plainly than they do.
Yeah.
So, well, let's continue on. Oh, by the way, I just happened to be listening, flipping channels the other day while I was eating, and here was a TV evangelist talking about Babylon being rebuilt.
Oh, you're kidding.
Oh. And I'm thinking, where did he get that from?
He had to have gotten it from, maybe they're listening to our audio files.
Well, he got it from somewhere. I don't know. But and then he hedged at the end. He said, well, I'm not sure, but it seems like it to me. Well, it either is or it isn't. You know, make a commitment.
Right.
And, you know, doesn't mean you have to be right all 100% of the time. But it was, I found that very, very amusing.
Yeah, that is.
But there's no way I'm ever going to know. You know, and now there was a, you know, one of the articles that we covered when the rebuilding of Babylon was written in the 1920s. So somebody could have encountered that article before, and then Dr. Martin wrote about it in the 70s, about the rebuilding of Babylon. So, I don't know, but I was greatly amused when I when I heard that. But anyway, back to Isaiah chapter 34, and let's look at verse 14, which is also very reminiscent of what will happen to Babylon in the future. But it's not talking about Babylon, remember. It's talking about Edom. And Edom calls together the nations of the world in Obadiah verse 1. And the day of recompense that God will give to Edom for their controversy with Zion, in other words, Edom's essentially attack on Zion, on Israel, quote, verse 14, the wild beasts of the desert shall also meet with the wild beasts of the island, and the satyr shall cry for his to his fellow. The screech owl also shall rest there and find for herself a place of rest, and there shall the great owl make her nest and lay and hatch and gather under her shadow, and there shall the vultures also be gathered, every one with her mate. In other words, all the unclean animals and birds will have carrion to eat, carrion from the dead bodies, from the wars, to eat all over the place. And the whole land of Edom will be turned into brimstone, running pitch. And, of course, brimstone means sulfur. And the smoke thereof going up all over the place and the whole land utterly demolished. Now, it says forever and ever, but it actually means to the end of the age.
Right.
And the book of Revelation says that Babylon will also be in a similar situation, but Isaiah chapter 34 is not talking about Babylon. It's talking about Edom. And, you know, if you don't keep those things separate, you can get confused, to say the least.
That's right.
Now, in Isaiah chapter 34, verse 5, it talks about the people of my curse, God's curse, which are the Edomites and not Babylon. Those people, the Edomites, are those people mentioned more than any other people in all the prophecies. And that's the Edomites. And if you analyze the book of Obadiah to and chapter 34 of Isaiah carefully and together, the Edomites have something to do with bringing together the world nations to take over Israel at the end of the age. Very likely the 10 nations in Ezekiel, in Psalm 83. They have the feeling, I suppose, that since they have the prophetic garment on them from their father Esau, well, they should be the ones to rule the world, take over the destiny of the world. And you can see this attitude coming in the Middle East peoples, this resentment against Israel, and that will bubble up and boil over against Israel at some time in the future. But first, everybody's going to get along commercially, and they're going to build up that area economically, probably with the help of good weather. And then there will be covenants made, and there will be covenants broken, and they will attack Israel. And, you know, and then, of course, the Antichrist is involved in all of this stuff, too. Mm-hmm. So, it's very involved.
It's complex.
Yeah, it's complex. And, you know, on the one hand, you can't fault people for not understanding things. But on the other hand, they should keep certain things straight and take them at face value, and then they'll do better.
They
struggle at the beginning, Esau and Jacob, and they struggle at the end. And that's the whole scene in a nutshell. Now look at verse 16 of Isaiah chapter 34. It says, "Seek out the book of the Lord and read. None of these shall fail. None shall want her mate. Not one of the prophecies shall fail." And that also means that they'll be associated with other prophecies.
Yeah.
Now, none shall want her mate also has to do with the vultures, the great owl. In other words, it's going to be a very prosperous time for the owls and the carrion. There's going to be so much stuff there for so long that there'll be multiple generations of carrion to eat for the owls and the vultures and the other beasts.
They'll be so fat they won't be able to fly.
But they will be able to mate, because it talks about hatching, like nesting and laying and hatching in verse 15.
Yeah.
So now here's a male vulture with a female vulture, and they mate and have little vultures, and they grow more and more vultures.
Mm-hmm.
And they do that to cleanse the land, actually. God says, you know, that they're doing this to get rid of all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Usually after a war, the losers have to bury the bodies.
Right.
Like when they entered the concentration camps, they collected the German people and forced them to bury the dead from the concentration camps. Well, God has the animals do that.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't have the people do that. So the vulture shall have her mate, the owl shall have her mate, and all the other unclean animals will have their mate, and they're going to take care of the whole land of Edom. Mm-hmm. Verse 16, quote, "None shall want her mate, for my mouth it has commanded, and his spirit it has gathered them, all of the unclean animals, and he has cast the lot for them, for the unclean animals, and his hand has divided it, the land of Edom, unto them," in other words, given it to the animals, "by line." In other words, one has some here, and some has and another one has some there. "And they shall possess it forever," for the age, "from generation to generation of the animals," the unclean beasts, "shall they dwell there in Edom." In other words, Edom is not going to be fit for human habitation because of the dead and the rotting bodies and because of the animals.
Right.
"Now Babylon will suffer the same thing as Edom," but you have to keep those prophecies separate. God must have some great controversy with the Edomites to give a judgment on that nation like this.
Yeah.
And it is a powerful judgment because of all the people that should be helping Israel, they should be helping their brother Jacob. And it's brother against brother. And like we said about twins, you know, that's not like the Babylons or the Egyptians, because you can imagine them turning against Israel, and they will. But brother turning against brother, that's a little bit too much. However, all this is prophesied in Scripture, and God knows what he's doing, and there's no unrighteousness with God. And the people of Edom are the people of my curse, God says, Isaiah 34, verse 5. So, which is the most significant in the Gentile nation in the Bible? It's Esau, Edom, Idumea. All of these refer to the same people. And if you follow the references through, you'll find more prophecies about the brother nation of Jacob than all the others.
Wow.
And so Edom is the most important Gentile nation in the Bible.
Wow. And we're going to be seeing just how important it is.
Yes.
Shortly. Oh, my gosh.
On the earth, coming to you real soon.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. I wonder if Fox News, CNN will be over there reporting it. Oh.
Well, I don't know. Corporations come and corporations go.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh.
We'll see.
Well, this is going to be...
There used to be a major network called the Mutual Broadcasting Network, but
yeah,
it's gone. Yeah, nations have life cycles, very long life cycles. Companies have life cycles, and so do people and animals.
Well, during all this time that Edom is going to be dealt with, is there anything about this land, this country, David?
The United States?
Yeah.
We'll be in lockstep with the Antichrist. Beyond that, I don't think there is anything specific.
Mm.
To a certain extent, we certainly have an Edomite heritage.
Yeah.
Because we're the leading commercial power on the earth.
Yeah.
Bar none. And, you know, if China overtakes us, it's only because they have more people. But they have a long way to go, and they'll probably have some type of economic collapse before we do. The power of the United States shall continue to grow, but it will decrease relative to other nations, in my opinion. And that's all that it is. How we fit in Scripture, you'd think the most powerful nation would, but not always. At many times through history, China was the most powerful nation on earth, and you don't see anything about it in prophecy. Likewise, you know, the Islamic nations were very powerful.
Right.
You don't see them. It's Scripture is concerned with the geography around Palestine and Israel, the land of Israel.
Right.
It's not concerned with, you know, lands in South America or North America.
Hmm.
And, you know, you can't get much farther away than the United States.
Well,
I suppose Australia. But
we have a lot of, shall we call them, wicked and evil people in high places that could do good things, but they don't.
And we are the best at projecting our power, definitely.
Yeah.
So, you know, beyond that, if you come up with something, let me know. But there's been some thoughts that, well, we're the ships of Tarshish.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't fit the geography.
Right.
The ships of Tarshish were Spain. That's pretty clear from Scripture and identifications, and because that's what they called themselves.
Yeah.
Now, it may have been the Edomites who were the Tarshish peoples, because there were Phoenician colonies in Spain as well as North Africa in Carthage.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they're They did the tin mines in Spain. They mined silver in Spain and then tin in Britain. Mm-hmm. So they were all over, and they probably made it to, you know, America. Their ships were certainly capable of doing that. After all, Solomon talks about an expedition that went out for 3 years to get gold and other things using the Phoenician ships from Tyre that literally King Solomon hired and outfitted the ships, which Hiram, then in a joint venture between Solomon and Hiram, sent out on this great three-year expedition for gold. Now, where they exactly went, we don't know, but a three-year trip could take you to circumnavigate the globe.
Well, in our country, they have found runestones and things like
mm-hmm.
that, you know, have a very, very ancient type of Hebrew.
Right, which might be a form of Phoenician. They may have been a common language.
Yes.
Between the two,
uh-huh.
Common written language,
yeah.
That we may not quite have the full details about.
Right.
So I have, you know, I don't have a lot of information on that, but it is interesting. The Phoenicians usually, you know, when Westerners go from the east to the west, they take their animals with them.
Mm-hmm.
When peoples come from the east to America, I'm sorry, from the west to America, those peoples don't take their animals and livestock with them. So what do we have? It indicated to Dr. Martin that very likely those peoples the indigenous peoples in the Americas came from the west and not the east. In other words, they came from Asia and Indonesia and, you know, the Philippines and those areas rather than, and they're the ones that settled rather than the ones from the, you know, from Europe. The Phoenicians may have made it here, but they didn't, and maybe set up a trading colony, but they didn't come here to live and stay. Whether for the weather's sake of the weather, or who knows, inhospitable natives, or who knows. But yeah, there are stones that are very interesting and anomalous, and what I don't like is when such things are ignored.
Yeah,
I think all of reality has to be taken into account, no matter how unusual or how strange.
Good point.
And, you know, because it's out there. It's not like you can selectively or correctly choose what to ignore.
Yeah.
You know, when I was on an archaeological dig, I saw them throw away pieces of pottery because it didn't match what they were supposed to have found at that strata. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, this doesn't seem like a valid technique.
Yeah, really. Oh, my
but,
gosh.
You know, it wasn't my dig, so I, you know, wasn't going to say anything.
Yeah.
And they just threw it in a separate pile and said, oh, well, that must have come from trade.
Yeah, right.
Well, I don't know.
Maybe, maybe not.
Yeah, maybe it was from maybe you have the strata. It's very similar. Archaeology is a lot like, you know, geologists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they date the geologic column by the fossils, and they date the fossils by the geologic column,
mm-hmm.
none of which ever are in proper full total sequence.
Right.
Archaeologists do the same thing. That's why they're so desperate to find any types of writings possible that would expand the database of the vocabulary,
right.
And make it understandable so that you can place a particular find in time. You know, so it's very, very interesting.
This whole topic has been very interesting, and
it's a little busy and a little difficult.
Well, it's complicated, Dave.
Yeah, yeah.
And we've got a lot more work to do on a lot of different topics that shed light here and there, you know. I mean, there's just a treasure trove of information, and wow, I appreciate so much you presenting these things, because it's very helpful to people. There's a lot of people out there that won't read, but they will listen to an audio file, and God bless them, you know, for that, because these are things that, you know, as time goes by and someone may have heard this audio file, something happens in the world and they think, you know, it's like an aha moment.
Yeah, and somebody knew back then.
Yeah, exactly.
And in this case, it was, you know, it was Dr. Martin knew way back when.
Yes, he did.
In 1977.
That's right.
But, you know, these things did not take... He expected these things to have taken place by now.
Mm.
He really did.
Yeah.
He thought, well, you know, it couldn't take as long, you know, this long. But before he died, he wrote an article called The Great Generation, in which he changed his conclusions that it would be, not just because he was dying, or near, you know, he had a heart attack and this was his last article, that he was not quite in a final stage of completion, and I was able to make a good article out of it. Called The Greatest, well, The Last Generation or Greatest Generation. I'm sorry, I can't think right now, but it had to do with that it's going to be a long time.
Yeah.
100 years he foresaw from 1998 or more or less, but that prayer could change the time frame in terms of shortening it.
Right.
And, you know, remember it says, lest these days be shortened. There'll be no flesh left alive.
Oh,
well,
Lord, look what's going on in the Middle East.
You know, they need to learn to love their children more than their own hatred of each other.
Yeah.
Because they love to hate. And it's just the status quo is intolerable.
I know.
And what to do on a day-by-day basis, you know, I don't have those types of solutions. I have, you know, I can make suggestions, but the tough thing making decisions when you're a government person.
That's
very
right.
Difficult. That's why we're commanded to pray for them.
Oh, absolutely. Oh.
Both so that they don't mess with us, but also, you know, for the good of the other people, that they do righteously.
Right.
You know, sometimes the government does judge righteously. You know, sometimes they do handle things correctly.
Mm.
Most of the time they don't, but
yeah.
You know, that's a personal opinion.
I kind of agree with you. Well, our time is at an end right now, and I want to ask everybody, please go and visit the website, askelm.com, and I believe you can email David Seeloff at, okay, it's David, D-A-V-I-D, at askelm.com. And, you know, if you have questions or want more information on the topics that we cover, go to the Ask Elm website. It's set up beautifully. It's easy to navigate. There is just a wealth of information on that website. And there are books there that you can purchase. There's a lot of free information. And
There's whole books that are free online.
Yes. There, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of things on that website that it you could spend a year there and just read and enjoy, because it is a wonderful website, and it's just full of information, and it's factual, it's scriptural information, it's very educational, it's food for the spirit. This, don't hang up, David. This is Georgianne Hughes with David Seeloff. He is the director of the Associates for Scriptural Knowledge. Go there, ask elm.com, and get acquainted with the website. It's a wonderful place. Okay, we will be back with another very educational topic very soon. As soon as David and I hash out which one it's going to be. And God bless all of you out there listening, and spread the word about AskElm.com and the audio files here at the Byte Show library page. It's all free, folks, so enjoy. And God bless you. This is Georgianne Hughes with David Seeloff, closing part two of The Most Significant Gentile Nation in the Bible. Good night, everybody. Say good night, David.
Good night.